Welcome to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. I'm Jane Wales, CEO. This week's episode focuses on the American voter who's squeezed by the pressures of globalization and fast-paced change. In this hour, we'll hear from sociologist Arlie Hochschild of UC Berkeley. This event was recorded in San Francisco before a World Affairs audience, and this broadcast is made possible by the generous support of Chevron. And now to our moderator, John Sepulvedo, host of the California Report at KQED Public Radio.
So, Berkeley sociology professor goes to the Deep South to talk about why folks have become political in the way that they have. How did that happen?
Well, there was a moment when I was sitting in my office in the sociology department at Berkeley when I thought, you know, this split is just, this was in 2011, but already you could see that Congress was at a standstill, that the rhetoric was escalating, that nothing of our last president's agenda is really going to happen. Not so much because the left was getting more left, but because the right was growing stronger. And that voice was getting louder. And I realized that I lived in a bubble, a geographic bubble, a media bubble, and an electronic bubble. You know, we open our laptops and discover ourselves. And I decided, you know, I really have to get out of this bubble and find a bubble that's as far right as sociology department at University of California, Berkeley, and Blue, California, is left. Not just to go there, but to try and take my own moral and political alarm system off and permit myself a great deal of interest and curiosity about the lives and beliefs of people I knew I would have fundamental differences with. Already at the beginning, I realize I'm going to have to climb an empathy wall to really get the hang of what it is to live in the shoes of these others. We do this all the time. That isn't an unusual thing. But we don't always do it toward people that we define as, quote, you know, the enemy or the other side, the other. So I thought, where would this other bubble be? It would be in the South, where the right has grown the fastest and strongest. But where in the South? Well, how about the Super South? And that would be either Mississippi or Louisiana. And it would be among whites, among hopefully evangelicals. That's who I wanted to try and get to know. And I went with this red state paradox that we all have. How could it be that throughout the country, it's the poorest states and the states with the worst health care, the worst education, the most disrupted families, the most on-the-road deaths, the lowest life expectancy, and worse pollution are the states that receive more money from the federal government in aid than they give to it in tax dollars and revile the federal government. Generally suspicious, distrustful. So that's the paradox. Geez, if you have these problems, wouldn't you want some help with them? And Louisiana turned out to be an exaggerated version of that as the second poorest state with 44% of its state money coming from the federal government. And it was overwhelmingly Tea Party and went overwhelmingly for Donald Trump in the last election. So I thought, perfect, this is just where I want to be, and I spent 5 years getting to know people.
We should, you know, just so people can have the proper context, Louisiana at this time was about 5-6 years removed from the failures of Hurricane Katrina, which was an unmitigated disaster. The governor at the time was Bobby Jindal, who was a staunch Republican. Many of our listeners and our audience members might remember that he was the governor who gave the first Republican response to President Obama. And he was kind of seen as a great hope for the GOP. To get back to this idea, though, of Berkeley sociologists going to the Deep South, did you just hop in a pickup truck and go to the first Winn-Dixie you saw in Lake Charles? Is that how you did it?
No. I got a plane ticket.
Oh, okay.
and thought about the gas that the plane would take and where the origin of that gas was, and it turned out to be largely Louisiana. And I knew one person in the state,
okay,
and that person was the mother-in-law of a former graduate student of mine at Berkeley, who does environmental sociology. Anyway, so she invited me down, and she was a progressive, an artist, progressive Democrat, but her best friend and Louisiana State University co-graduate was extremely enthusiastic Tea Party person. Mm-hmm. They had keys to each other's houses. They loved each other's kids. It had been multi-generational. The kids loved each other. And they were absolute opposites. So I thought, perfect. This will be interesting.
Now, I'm curious in this.
I stayed with both of them.
With both of these families.
Yeah.
I'm curious in this audience right now, how many people have been to this area of Louisiana, either Lake Charles or Sulphur, Louisiana, or anywhere along the oil corridor?
Yeah.
Okay, so we're seeing a smattering of hands. And how many people were just driving through on Interstate 10 when they went? Okay, good. Well, one person. Hopefully you did not drive fast, because there are many speed traps in that area. That is true.
You have been there.
I have been there, which is why I would like you to share with our audience, both here and on the radio, about what this area actually looks like. Because I think we often don't incorporate how the land is used and how it looks and how that really kind of influences our identity. So if we're going to talk about these folks' identity, let's really get an idea of where they are living.
Right. Well, this would be, Louisiana's a boot, and so it's the back heel part of the boot, of the southwest. And Lake Charles is a town of maybe 60,000 that, charming. It's, I stayed at a little bed and breakfast, Aunt Ruby's B&B, and kind of old-timey, kind of 19th century, very small. And as you walk around, you notice there are a lot of small churches, maybe every block or every other block, and a lot of personal injury law offices. Mm-hmm. So you think, what is there a relationship here? people are friendly. They look you in the eye. The sidewalks looked somewhat broken. And as you went out of town, you began to see homes that it not only looked smaller and poor, but didn't look tended. It spoke to a mood. Sometimes you could see a small, modest place, but with flowers and tended. You felt the morale of the person in the home was speaking to you. And there were areas of town where that was not true, but areas that there were. And there was a historic area, but kind of unprotected, because a cell tower had just been approved to go up in the historic center. So I thought, well, that's interesting about regulation. You know, is that a terrible thing or is it a good thing? People had a lot of civic pride. As I got into the friends' cars, they'd show me around to the things they were proud of, including parks.
It's interesting that you brought up the cell tower and kind of looking at it please forgive me, but an academic view, which is here we have a lot of regulation and something that kind of cuts across the atmosphere that the locals are trying to create. And the reason I say that is because Lake Charles is also home to a great refinery industry that stretches from there to Sulphur. So
The
nighttime when you drive by on I-10, you'll see these lights kind of blinking in this very barren industrial looking area, and it is just omnipresent. It doesn't matter which direction you look, because the land is very low, and the really the only trees are either along the streets or they're along the highways. And there's also a casino. And let's remember, it's a big casino town. And this is an area that, as a whole, is, I would say, and you can tell me because you spent more time there, but very evangelical in nature. The churches, like you say, are just as prominent as tort attorneys. Mm-hmm. So with this in
mind... As coffee houses are in Berkeley.
Yeah, so maybe they'll start serving espresso, but not too hot. So my question to you is, you met someone who had lived in this landscape, and you did a beautiful job of explaining it after the empathy walls in your first chapter. Take us to this man's house. Or this man's land and where it was on this red road that you talked about in the book.
Okay. I begin the book somewhere else, actually. So we've got the heel of the Louisiana boot. And if you go along the foot more to the toe side of it, you will meet a central character in the book. And he lived in a small town called Bayou Corn. Has anybody ever heard of Bayou Corn? Okay. And it wasn't very far from the lower loops of the Mississippi that is now called, with good reason, Cancer Alley, because the lower loops are where the old plantations used to be, where now petrochemical plants, Dow Chemical, Monsanto, Phillips 66, have actually bought that plantation lands, and some of them have their meetings in the old... in the old big houses. And so it isn't just a metaphor, but it is true that oil is the new plantation in the state of Louisiana, is the dominant industry, and dominates in cultural ways as well as political and economic ones. So anyway, I met a man. His name is Mike Schaff, and he was when I met him wearing a big Louisiana Tea Party T-shirt, and I thought, okay, it's just the kind of person I like to meet. And I met him at an environmental rally, but that I'll explain that in a bit. So how would the Tea Party person be at an environmental rally? Already, I'm wondering. So I get to meet him, and I ask him, can I see where you were born? And can I see the school that you went to, and you know, the church you went to, and where your parents are buried? And would that be okay? Yes, sure, he said. So I was born, he said, in a sugar plantation. So he takes me in his truck, and we're driving in this red, narrow road and 7 foot high sugar cane. And he was saying, well, now that's where my Uncle Pook had his garage, and this is where my grandparents lived. And he's pointing, and we're looking at sugar cane. What he's telling me is about a beloved a kind of home that he had. He was born the fifth of seven children of a plumber in a renovated slave home. He called it a shotgun house. Well, you know, the nine of us fit in just fine. And he has very fond memories. And all the people I interviewed basically would say, well, we were poor, but we didn't know it. Had a wonderful childhood and loved running barefoot and shooting crows. And
and the shotgun house is called that because you could go from a straight line from the front door to the back door.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. And so it, one of the things, first things he said, you know, the reason I don't like big government, the reason I'm a member of the Tea Party is that it takes community away. Isn't it, in other words, it does for you what neighbors and friends should do for each other. And it evoked his childhood. The paradox is that this man did lose his beloved community, not by too much government, but by the total absence of government. He lived on a bayou that developed a terrible sinkhole as a result of a drilling accident of an under-regulated drilling company, Texas Brine. And the lawns began to tilt, and there was earthquakes. There had never been earthquakes in this area, but suddenly earthquakes, shaking. He said, I thought I was having a heart attack, but no, it was an earthquake. And then bubbles in the bayou and in the rain puddles. It looked like Alka-Seltzer tablets. What's that? Methane gas. So a community of 360 had to be evacuated, and he didn't evacuate. He stayed there, even though it was dangerous. If you were to light a match with all that gas around, it could blow up. But he got a gas monitor and put it in his garage and stayed there. He couldn't bear to leave it because he loved his community. And so our conversations, as we later went out fishing, is, wait a minute, you love your community. I understand why you love it. It's beautiful. These bayous are extraordinary. Really, there's great physical magnificence there. And they love it. They love to fish. They love to hunt, the people, friends I came to know. But they didn't see the government as the protector of it.
Is there something to be said, though, that government has in many ways filled what has been the traditional role of the family? And in fact, that's kind of what government's been designed to do. Is there an argument to be made that there was a time if you were hungry, you would go to extended family if your own family didn't have it, especially in, like, let's say, a shotgun home where everybody's kind of stacked on each other. And you would, go ask your aunt or your uncle or your cousin or your neighbor for some bread. And now that doesn't necessarily exist. Now you would go to an office and apply for aid. Is there any truth to this what he's feeling at his core?
Well, it's interesting. It hasn't affected him that way. And I think it doesn't answer the question of inequality, because you have a poor person who would knock on a neighbor's door and the neighbor is also poor. And then you have a rich person who's knocking on his neighbor's door and it's another rich person. So it doesn't really help the people in the greatest need. And I think that's why the government is needed. But yeah, I can partly get it. But when it looks like he loves his environment, why wouldn't you want a state to protect it? And I think one thing that happened, and one reason he doesn't like the government, is that the Louisiana government is a bought government. Actually assigns to the state the moral dirty work of pretending to protect people while it doesn't protect people. And so he thought, well, look, if all governments are as corrupt as the one I happen to be having to live under, to heck with it. Why should I pay for it? So very understandable. But then it makes us ask the question, are there more such states in the red states? In other words, do people have a bum experience with state government and then project it onto the federal government, where indeed that's an important question for us to be asking. I mean, those of us who believe in good government have to really take a hard look at people's experience with bad government. And he'd been stung.
Let's go back to the heel now. So we were at the toe. let's get back to the heel. That's where I do my dancing anyways. Where were the people who you met in Sulphur, in Lake Charles, did they share a similar belief with Mike? And I would imagine that these people are not the same type of land-owning, big land-owning folks as Mike is, because it's just a different neighborhood, or it's a different landscape.
He didn't own a lot of land.
Okay.
He was, I had a college education and a modest house and absolutely extraordinary circumstances of environment, and he was rich in community. and treasure that.
And did you see those same characteristics in the folks who were in Lake Charles and in Sulphur?
Yes, they were. Are you asking me their social class? And that's a hard one, actually. Well, I would say they, if I had to stand back and look, of the 40 people that I really got to know well, I interviewed 60 people in all, that they were almost the elite of the left behind in a certain way. They
elite
weren't.
Elite of the left behind.
Yeah, they were not abjectly poor at all. I did once have dinner with a homeless man who asked I was eating alone, could he join? And in the course of the conversation, I asked him about his politics, and he was pretty Tea Party and Republican too. So it's not that really poor people aren't very conservative too, but these were people who, all of whom had struggle stories. That's what they wanted to tell me, was that they had struggled and that their parents had struggled. And many were the children of pipe fitters and operators in the petrochemical plants, mm-hmm. and worked during an era when there was very little regulation, and this was dangerous work, and they were handling toxic chemicals, which are in all of the bodies of water in this area. It was one of the 2% most polluted in the country. So that's, they had a feeling about themselves that they had worked extremely hard, and they had. This fellow, Mike, I asked him, do you love to fish? Do you ever get any time out fishing? Well, he said at his last place of work, he had gotten, for the first 5 years there, 1 week of vacation, at sick time and vacation together for the first 5 years. For the next 5 years at that place of work, he got 2 weeks off. So if you get a cold, then you have 1 week. So he was dying to retire and finally get a chance to do the thing he most loved, which was to fish. Put himself through college, and I heard a lot of stories like that. And
of pulling yourself up by the bootstraps, essentially.
Yes.
So one of the things we talked about before we came to the stage was that just as you had been in the South for a long time, I actually lived in the South, the Deep South, for quite a while, including my time as a correspondent at CNN. I spent a lot of time in Louisiana, but also along the Mississippi Delta, all the way up to Tennessee. And I had noticed, there were two things I told you. The first was that when I was living in the South, especially in the more rural communities, that if I heard, and I'm a native Californian, I want to say that, but if I had heard that a fancy sociologist from Berkeley was coming down to look at us, I would have been offended by that, because there would have been almost like a observing people at the zoo or something like that kind of mentality. So how did you present yourself? How did people receive you, and how did you walk that line from, you know, again, like that kind of looking at someone almost as though they're in a human zoo, as opposed to really yeah. trying to extract their story and understand who they are?
Well, you know, I think I just came in as this floppy woman with gray hair and, you know, retired teacher. Why would I be there? You know, why would I be there? And I say, look, I'm really worried about this divide. And actually, you know, I think we're all American and we're all wonderful people. And I don't understand how this division has gotten this harsh. We're not talking to each other. And they would immediately say, you know what? We're worried about that too. Thanks for coming. And by the way, people, the liberal coastal people, think that we're backward and we're the flyover state and we have no culture and we're ill-educated. And you set them straight. Yeah, I'll talk to you, sure. Yeah. So that was great. They were generous and open. And I'm ever lastingly grateful for that. I just went back.
Oh, but, did you?
Yeah, yeah. And went back with my son, who is a big environmentalist.
I'm sure the two of you were a big hit.
And and we went back to visit my friend Mike Schaff, who voted for Trump, who's going to abolish the Environmental Protection Agency. And so I wanted a conversation between my son, who's big, you know, renewable energy guy, and Mike. And I said, well, look, I'm just going to hold the tape recorder. Let's go out fishing. And you guys, can you figure out a way to have no more bayou corn sinkholes happen in this country? How can we do it? Can we do that without a good government? I mean, and so and there was common ground, by the way. I know you're going to get to that, but there is a lot of common ground you can have with people that you think you have very fundamental differences with and do have differences.
Harley, why didn't you bring that tape here? We would have loved to hear that. We could have pressed play and that would have been it. I have two more questions before we go to the audience questions. Another thing we were talking about backstage before we came out, and again, this is something I noticed in the South, and I want to make clear that these are my words, but I felt, especially when I lived in a place like Atlanta or I lived in Rome, Georgia, which is in the Appalachian foothills, I never met a family who hadn't somehow been connected to Sherman's March 2C. Every single family, it didn't matter if they were from China or India or if had somehow lived through the March to Sea. And I'm being a little bit facetious and exaggerating just a bit. It's one of the things I picked up in the South. But the point was is that everyone had this tale of woe and this tale of hardship. And I found it to be very empowering myself because all of a sudden I started thinking, yeah, I kind of pulled myself up too. And yeah, you know, it wasn't the total education system that got me to where I was. You know, I did it myself. I had my own book. But at the same time, there was a sense of, and this, these are my words, that I found perpetual victimhood. That there was always this kind of victim mentality that we were oppressed, we overcame, and now we're oppressed again and we're overcoming. And that became a huge part of the narrative and the through line I saw. Am I wrong in that? Did you see that? And if so, how did you document it and how do you address it in your book?
Wow, that's a great question. Actually, on the face of it, I saw almost the opposite. They didn't see themselves as victims and they didn't like liberals with their great list of victims, you know, the oppressed, browbeaten woman, the never have an opportunity black, the you know, misunderstood transsexual. They said, well, all these poor dears is what waiting in line for a government for solicitation for sympathy, and so they didn't want to be a poor dear, but they did and they didn't. I actually think it was a dilemma for them and a conflict that life had been hard and it had called on a great deal of stoicism that they felt progressives didn't see or appreciate. And yet they felt like they were being put in the back of the line.
Wouldn't that suggest though, that they're being the victim, that they're essentially being victimized by being put in the back of this line?
That's right. They felt like victims, but they disdained the act of claiming victimhood. That was the conflict.
That seems like a cognitive dissonance the same as wanting no regulation, but being upset when no regulation leads to the disappearance of something beloved in the community.
They're not the only ones with contradictions, by the way.
Oh, yes. I want to make it very clear.
Our good share.
This type of contradiction and these types of stories are throughout the human condition. It's just these are the specific ones I saw specifically in the South.
And that's the point of the book is to kind of open out that conversation.
You're listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. I'm Jane Wales, CEO. We're hearing from sociologist Arlie Hochschild of the University of California, Berkeley. This event was recorded in San Francisco before a World Affairs audience. And now back to our moderator, John Sepulvedo.
When you went there, you brought Berkeley with you to the Deep South. What of the Deep South did you bring back to Berkeley?
I felt like I was visiting a region, a quite extraordinary region, but also a kind of a blue-collar class is the words that's given to it. But people who work hard with their hands and are just as smart as anybody else, but get put down and are diffident, feel like they are put down. And it occurred to me that actually the whole way we talk about the American dream, we talk about Wall Street, okay, that's the 1%, and then we talk about Main Street. But even Main Street suggests that you're you have a little stationer store or a coffee shop. How about the person who climbed the telephone poles and put in all the wiring, the people that put the pipes in, the people you can't see who built Main Street? Mm-hmm. I think there's something missing in our very language that eclipses an appreciation for people who have all kinds of jobs that are invisible. I came home with that.
It sounds like you came home with a greater understanding of how to scale that empathy wall that you were talking about earlier. Did you come home with your politics changed at all?
No, not at all. But I realize how we look to them. And it's not good. It's not good. And I understand better why we sometimes, for starters, that the University of California, Berkeley, can't have a speaker who
Milo
speaks
there.
Yes, and that there were was violence. The anarchist Black Bloc people. My friends in Louisiana saw that on television. Said, "Oh, so the liberals are the fascists." And why wouldn't they think that? Why haven't we stopped that? Why aren't there words instead of fists?
When you are speaking with folks, maybe at Berkeley, for example, and you're talking about Milo Yiannopoulos, who has made a career out of saying the most inflammatory things possible, racially degrading, gender degrading, essentially treating human beings as less than. Let's not forget who he is before we...
Yes.
Can we condone why some people were upset that he came to Berkeley or didn't come to Berkeley. When you talk to your friends at Berkeley about this, have you changed the way that you talk to them? Are you more able to relay the way your friends in Louisiana are feeling to them? Do you hear things maybe the way they talk about your friends in Louisiana or other folks in Louisiana or the South and feel offended by that on their behalf?
The people I met wouldn't agree with everything Milo says, for starters. And they think that, all progressives think they're terrible racists. Mm-hmm. And they think that's an epithet they're always having to push off. So they wouldn't agree with him. And they wouldn't agree with him on gender. All of the women I talked to worked and wanted equal pay for equal work. And they were Tea Party and voted for Trump. So we have to hold some contradictions here.
And also, the Ledbetter of the Ledbetter Act came from the South. We shouldn't forget that part either.
It makes me sad that there isn't a forum where reasonable people, it speaks to a weakness, I believe, on the liberal side, and it speaks to the terrible absence of a plethora of public forums such as this, where people of different minds get together and talk over their differences in a civil way. Why is that missing in the whole country? And I think there is actually now a people-to-people movement coming. It's very small, but if you check out the Bridge Alliance, it will mention some 70...
Bridge Alliance.
Yes.
Okay.
That mentions a number of different groups that have titles like Better Angels or High from the Other Side or Living Room Conversations. And I think we need a lot more of that. You know, I just got a call from a guy who is a Democratic member of the House who represents Silicon Valley. Bo Khanna, his name is. Mm-hmm. And so Facebook, Google, Yahoo, that's who he represents. And I wondered why he was calling me. Well, he has gotten together with a Republican from Kentucky, and they have cooperated on a project to get coders, being trainers, to come from Silicon Valley and go to train unemployed coal miners and their young kids.
In Appalachia.
In Appalachia. It's called Paintsville, and they're calling it Silicon Hollow. But there had to be a political bridge. In other words, I think we are who we are. We're not going to morph into something different. We have our identities. But what we can do is find common ground on following kinds of issues. One is find the urgency of getting good jobs for people who are faced with unemployment. And automation is the elephant in the living room. So that's a common ground issue. I believe clean energy is a common ground energy thing. And you even have a lot of agreement on reducing prison populations, for example. And even George Soros and Charles Koch got together to give money for that purpose. Of course, Trump is now countering that. But in other words, people to people, we agree on more than we think we do. And I think while being who we are, essentially who we are, we can still find common ground. We can still be civil to each other.
You know, it's interesting that you said Koch and Soros, just because when we look at kind of the left and the right conspiracies, those two are basically responsible for every single action that has ever happened since their birth.
Right.
Amazing men.
Yeah.
One last question before we go to the audience questions. So as a sociologist, did you come to a better political understanding of why people joined the Tea Party and now have many turned into Team Trump?
Yeah. I think that I could say this, that they know about the red state paradox. They're perfectly aware of that. They're embarrassed by it. You know, why are we so poor? They make jokes, but they're embarrassed. And they do want help, but they don't want government help. Or at least not certain kinds of government help. But I came to think that underlying all of our politics, left and right, there is a deep story. What's a deep story? Deep story is a story that feels true. You take facts out of it. You take moral judgments out of it. It's just what feels in your gut true. And that they have theirs, we have ours. But the right-wing deep story is that you're waiting in line, as in a pilgrimage, facing at the top of the hill where there's the American dream. And your feet are tired, and it hasn't moved. Mike Schaff hadn't had a raise in 2 decades. And you're waiting for your reward. You feel you deserve it. And then in this right deep story, there are line cutters. Well, who are the line cutters? They would be blacks who, through federal affirmative action programs, finally have access to jobs that have been reserved for whites. And even more numerous women who, through federally mandated affirmative action programs, now have access to jobs that have been reserved for men. I'm an example. And then immigrants and refugees. And these are the people that liberals are telling them to feel sympathy for. In another moment of the right-wing deep story, you see Barack Obama, who seems to be waving to the line cutters as they feel, oh, he's their president. He's sponsoring them and not me. I'm being moved back in line. And then they ask, well, isn't he a line cutter too? How did a single mother, his mother, who's not a rich woman, afford a Harvard education? Oh, something fishy, something fishy. They can't imagine that there are full scholarships for brilliant students at elite universities, which
well, also foreign
there
students.
Are. He wasn't foreign. Oh, man. You make me feel I'm going back there. I know.
So, the line cutters, though, and I'm sorry, I didn't mean to derail that with the obligatory birth certificate joke. That being said, the line, and we're seeing that today. We're seeing that in the rise of white nationalism that is happening in your neighborhood of Berkeley. Actually, we're seeing a strong recruitment effort there. One of the largest white nationalist groups is in Modesto, not too far from here, and they're doing everything they can to recruit on this idea that there are people who have been pushed to the front of the line at the expense of white people, generally of European heritage. Mm-hmm. Is that what you found in the South?
Yes. That is the deep story. That's how it feels to them. And then they feel that someone ahead of them in line is turning around, someone born on the coast, someone with higher education, and saying, you ignorant, prejudiced, racist, sexist, homophobic people, you're rednecks. And then something snaps. Then they feel that's the ultimate insult, and they feel, okay, they have become a minority group. It's not represented in the polity. And so the end of my research, I went to a primary rally for Donald Trump, and I saw the excitement of this group and, every red, white, and blue posters and Elton John music, the excitement of this thing. And I thought, I've been studying for 5 years the dry kindling, and now I see the match.
Well, on that hopeful note, Arlie Hochschild is the author of Strangers in Their Own Land. We are speaking, we're going to go now to audience questions. And the first one is, what are your suggestions for fostering community and rebuilding that sense of community within let's stay focused within these particular groups where they feel that the federal government is somehow supplanting their community?
They have a lot of community. I was very impressed, actually, by it. You walk down Ryan Street. Oh, hey, didn't I see you in church? And so it was had a kind of a small town feel. I think they partly felt that three things: that the government, federal government, was an instrument of the North, and the North was always wagging its moral finger and telling the South that it was wrong, and they saw the government as the instrument of inept bureaucrats who, in fact, were enacting the interests of oil. Mm. I think that they were exposed to a bad government. And thirdly, that they saw the government as an instrument of line cutters. So they didn't see robots cutting in line. You know, they didn't see industry as reducing the number of jobs or look at it structurally like that. But I think we have to get together in 1,000 town halls and talk over what good government could look like. And that supports community. That's what I think government should do.
In your view, your metaphor of the standing in line that you were just speaking about, how would the people you interviewed view the educated elite? Would they look at them as already living the American dream? Would they of taking cuts in this line, helping others take cuts in this line. Perhaps the asker of this question already knew the answer because they gave you the option of all of the above.
So the educated, how do they feel about the educated elite?
About the quote-unquote educated elite. Like, how do the folks you spoke to feel about the educated elite?
Out of touch. That they're out of touch and smart in some ways and not in others. And I think both things are true.
You do think those are true?
Yeah. I think there is an out of touchness, yes. Yes, I do.
Do you feel before you went that perhaps you were out of touch?
Do I believe in science? Yeah. Yes, of course I do. Yeah. And it breaks my heart, really, what's happening in Louisiana. It breaks my heart. This should not be such a polluted place, and there should be science for the people and great implementation of it on the part of government officials.
We should say about Louisiana, I got my start in journalism at the Texas State House. And I was at the Texas State House my first year when the Democrats left the state, some of you might remember this, to avoid Tom DeLay's redistricting plan. And they were supposed, and if by leaving the state, they left a quorum. My point with it is that Texas Democrats were supposed to go to Sulphur, Louisiana, because it's right over the border, but they said it was too dirty for them. To be too dirty for a Texan is a whole other level of dirty. And so they went to Ardmore, Oklahoma instead. That's a true story.
Mm-hmm.
This is a large question with an answer that could be full of nuance. And it presupposes something. But A, do you believe that people vote against their own interests? And if so, what can be done to get them not to vote against their own interests?
Well, I think liberals vote against their own interests in certain ways, too, if you look at interests in a very narrow way. I mean, most progressives feel that it's a good and moral duty to pay taxes because they believe in good government and want protected environments. And here in California, we have a more protected environment because we have good environmental laws and honest people enforce it on the whole. So, but you could say that, you're departing from all that tax money, you don't resent it, but is it in your interest to pay it? Well, we think it is, you know, but you could look at it. They don't think it is in our interest. So that looks like a contradiction from the point of view of the Tea Party people I met.
And it should be. I really do think there's a lot of truth to what you said earlier, that a lot of these governments are very poorly ran. They're sparsely staffed. They're run on a shoestring budget. The last populist I can think of to come out of Louisiana was Huey Long. Yeah. So there is very much an element of just poorly ran government to begin with.
I asked Mike Schaff, who's the best governor you ever had? And he voted for Bobby Jindal, mm-hmm. who has wrecked the place.
He was
twice.
Universally, so much so that a Democrat actually seceded him.
Yeah.
I mean, it's got to be bad. Just the same way for Texans to go to Louisiana, it's got to be bad if Louisianans
and
are
Mike,
going to a Democrat.
Mike voted for that Democrat.
John Edward Bell.
Yeah. But that's right. But his answer to who the best governor was, it was Huey Long.
Yeah. Huey Long.
And that was a chicken in every white pot and a chicken in every black pot. That was Huey Long.
And of course, he was shot. How do you feel about Matthew McConaughey? Completely out of left field. Do you think he's as dreamy as I do? Because we're going to go now to True Detective. It takes place in in Lake Charles, Louisiana. Stars Matthew McConaughey and Woody Harrelson.
Yeah.
Now, the Southern cultural portrayal was a real draw for the show. And the person in our audience wants me to ask, do you believe that the coasts have this morbid fascination with the South and Southern culture, this type of True Detective, William Faulkner, Arthur Miller fascination of what they think the South is?
That's a fascinating question. Yes, I would, but I would say Louisiana was used like wallpaper in that series, that it was just a kind of a backdrop. I didn't see anything about how real Southerners, you know,
there was one element.
Families and communities and...
When they talked about the private schools, I thought that that was really interesting because everyone in Louisiana knows that if you want your children to get a good education, the best thing to do if you're in any type of urban area is to send them to a private school, generally a Catholic parochial school. Mm-hmm. Did you find that when you were...
Was that in the...
There was an element of that in True Detective. Yeah,
was there?
Yeah, about sending the kid to a religious Baptist school.
Forgot that.
That's okay.
Yeah. Well, then...
I forget things all the time, too. But I'm not forgetting to end in just about 5 minutes. We talked earlier about Hurricane Katrina, and we should say, I mean, it was an absolute disaster and a tragedy what happened, mainly because we could see it coming. What role impact did you see Hurricane Katrina having played in influencing this in Louisiana? Did it play any role, or were the attitudes and beliefs already set before that even happened?
I'm going to take that question a particular direction, if I can. They were made to feel helpless, and they needed federal help, but they felt that it was inadequately. It was the FEMA trailers had mold and stuff like that. It was bad help, so they both felt helpless and needed help, but they got mad at the government. Mm. But one wonderful thing came out of it, and that is a man named General Russell Honoré, who is a legend in Louisiana. He was a rescuer. He was after Bush's Brownie. Remember, you're doing a great job, Brownie. Well, after that disaster, Honoré came in, and he's now become a great environmentalist. He stands, 6'5" or something, biracial, very well spoken, and he has an extraordinary capacity to take symbols that are meaningful on the right and apply them just to stretch them and make them. I'll give you an example. He was talking to some businessmen, Honoré was, and who think about freedom, 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 you know, and who were against environmentalism. Okay, so Honoré said, "Well, I was out this morning looking out Lake Charles. I saw a man out in a boat, and he had his line out, and his bucket was ready to pull up fish. But that man is not free to lift out an uncontaminated fish." I thought, you genius. I would just love the whole country to learn how to take symbols that are meaningful and true, but apply them in ways that maybe people hadn't thought about.
And what is his name?
General Russell Honoré, Honore, and he should be honored.
Is he a general or is he just a
4-star? Yeah, retired now.
Thank you.
One of the groups that is I found not mentioned a lot in this book. And it also, I'm sure you read the book White Trash, which came out, you know, around the same time as your book. And both specifically address the issue of essentially this whiteness in the South to varying degrees. You do incorporate much more than White Trash does. White Trash is a history of being poor and white in the South. But for every person who complains about the federal government and their largesse, I can know a black family who can turn around and say, well, if it wasn't for the federal government, we would still be going to segregated schools. Uh-huh. We would still be facing the potential of violence and discrimination that is codified in law. We'd still maybe even perhaps, who knows in this atmosphere, be seeing some of the things that Ida B. Wells describes 100 years ago. What role, and you have 2 minutes, what role does the racial identity of white folks play in their hatred, their dislike for the federal government and sometimes their outward hatred for regulations?
I think it's deeply important, but I don't think it's confined to the South. I think it all depends on how you define racism. Now, the people I came to know said, we're not racist, I'm not a racist, but how did they define racism? Well, they would say, like this Mike Sheff said, he said, well, I'm a reformed bigot, is what he said. Yeah. I said, what's a bigot? And he said, well, a bigot is someone who hates blacks. I've never hated blacks. Or who uses the N-word. And I did used to use the N-word. But said, now I'm offended by it. So if someone used that word on my Facebook page, I unfriend them. You know, it's offensive to me. But the people on the Democratic side, they use the R-word, redneck. So that's how he saw
it. In your estimation, and your based on what you observed and what you experienced, you saw that there was an equivalence between the word redneck and the N-word.
They felt that. That's what I'm saying. I think my definition of racism is a much more structural one. Mm-hmm. You know, if a black widow couldn't rent one of Donald Trump's apartments in the 1970s, well, that's a policy thing. That's a practice. That's not just what word you use.
We also see a large number of Latinos and Hispanics come, especially after Hurricane Katrina, to Louisiana, and they have stayed. They've built specifically in like Shreveport, Baton Rouge. What is the feeling towards immigration, and do they feel that it's mainly Latinos?
Yes, they do. But they have enormous respect, actually,
for the work ethic.
Mexicans.
Yeah.
Undocumented workers. They're like us. They're workers. And they actually said, you know, whites don't work as hard as Mexicans do. So there was a kind of respect, a tipped hat, even while they were threatened by it. And indeed, the big petrochemical plants being developed now, Sasol, for example, there are new man camps being built, mainly by Mexican labor. And in the man camps will go Filipino pipe fitters who will be imported at a cheaper rate to work. So in a way, they see whites as being bypassed, not by blacks, but by these other groups. And yet they reserve the most fear for Muslims, of which there are almost none in Louisiana. But the language is, you know, the fear, it's a real magnet for what represents danger from the outside. Yeah.
Before we open the floor for discussion with those of you who are in the room, I would like to say goodnight to our radio listeners and thank Arlie Hochschild for this excellent discussion. Many thanks to you as well as the audience for your terrific questions. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. Ours is a nonprofit membership organization. We're dedicated to engaging the public in conversations that matter. This program featured sociologist Arlie Hochschild. She's at the University of California, Berkeley. She was in conversation with John Sepulvedo, host of the California Report on KQED Public Radio. This broadcast is made possible weekly by the generous support of Chevron. Our recording engineer is Stanton Burns. Our technical supervisor is Monte Carlos. World Affairs is produced in association with KQED Public Radio. I'm Jane Wales. Thank you for joining us.